Before we kick off with the program, I just wanted to announce our upcoming online retreat and intensive. It'll run from November 26th to 29th, so that's coming up later this month. And in honour of Bhagwan's birthday, the theme of this retreat is going to be Strike the Match, Light the Fire. You can visit satsanglive.com.au to find out more and to register.
Great chant. Very nice chant. So now it's time for Kids Darshan. And we'll say hello to all the kids watching. So in Byron Bay, Rafi and Molly, hello. And in Melbourne, Liam and Finley. And around the peninsula, we have Sammy and Vaishnava, Santosi and Josh. And Safira and Patrick and Mukti. And Harvey and Ocean and Leo. Hi, kids. Welcome to Satsang. So, as Paramananda told you, tonight we're celebrating Diwali, which is the festival of light, sometimes called the Hindu New Year. It celebrates Lord Ram's victory over the demon Ravana and his rescuing of his wife, Sita. It celebrates the victory of light over darkness, good over evil, and knowledge over ignorance. Associated with Diwali is the tradition that Lord Dhanvantari, the Hindu god of medicine, and who's an incarnation of Vishnu, and said to have brought Ayurveda and the nectar of immortality to the world, that he was born on this day. Also, the goddess Lakshmi was born from the churning of the ocean on this day, and she's the primary deity worshipped during Diwali. So it's a very auspicious day in which traditionally people wear new clothes, they get their house all renovated and cleaned up, and we all celebrate beauty and abundance. So in honor of Diwali, we're going to chant the Lakshmi Stotram, and I guess we'll have it up on the board. Do we have that? It's online. You online people can see it. We all have it here in front of us. And we'll do this, a beautiful chant to Lakshmi for abundance, for health, for wealth, for bliss, for joy, for upliftment, for everything you could possibly want. So let's do that now.
Namaste to Mahamaya.
Saying in Hindi, and what was it again? Subko bare sammane ke saath prem se hardik swagat. With great respect and love, I welcome you all my heart. And he would always say that to welcome another person was the essence of spirituality. So in that spirit, I welcome all of you in the room and all of you in the global satsang. Welcome to the program. Baba also said, constant and independent contentment is the sign of a being who has attained that. They always capitalize that when they mean the ultimate. When a seeker becomes worthy of attaining the absolute, his mind becomes unshakable and contented. He has steady wisdom. He's anchored in the self, not going up and down like we do. The path of the siddhas leads to the wisdom of the supreme principle. During the rainy season, Baba says, there are floods, but in autumn the river becomes quiet and its turbulence calms down. At the end of a song, the accompanying drum beat dies out. In the same way, one's striving and tension vanish the moment one attains self-realization. The serenity and joy of this state are the glory of self-realization. At this point, one is flooded with the awareness of inner contentment. A fountain of joy dwells up in one's heart when one's awareness becomes stable. Then one has attained siddhahood. One is awarded the highest certificate from the Siddha University. Oh, friend, make sure that you get the right certificate. That's the best certificate to get. And one of those who got the highest certificate is my subject tonight. In honor of Diwali, I thought it would be fitting to look at the teachings and life of one of India's greatest woman saints. And her name is Ananda Mahima. And she's somebody that I met. She's the first great being that I met maybe 2 days into getting to India. A little longer than that, maybe 5 days after. I happened to have the good fortune to have the darshan of Sri Ananda Mahima. And she was, this is what she looked like when I met her. She was born on the 30th of April, 1896, makes her a Taurus. And she died on the 27th August, 1982. If you figure that out, it's just a month before Baba died, late August, 1982. And she was a spiritual genius. Her father was a Vaishnavite, a very pious Vaishnavite Brahmin, an devotional singer. And she had a spontaneous Kundalini awakening when she was quite young, and she started doing spiritual kriyas and movements from the awakened Kundalini. This is without doing any sadhana with a guru or any practice or so on. And during her sadhana, she never had a physical guru, but she split into two. She became the guru and the disciple. And she's very peculiar. And she went through it, and she was quite remarkable. People around realized she was a holy woman. Eventually, she got married, and her husband, who was named Bolanath, became her greatest devotee. She was very humble and also very peculiar. She would talk about herself like this child, like a little girl, and she'd talk about this body, this child. And she was noted for her kayals, which are... what can you say, spiritual moods, spiritual impulses. She would have a kayal and then she would eat 80 chapatis, things like that. Then she'd have another kayal and she wouldn't eat for 2 weeks. You could never tell. It was like the divine Shakti just moved her in different ways. Why don't we see a couple of other photos? That's her as... this is her during her sadhana when the Kundalini was moving her to doing various movements. You can see she's very young there. And then what else do we have? This is in middle age, surrounded by devotees. So early on, it became clear that she was a very special being, and people were attracted to her, and soon she had masses of devotees, and she would give darshan and so on. But not only was she moody or peculiar in a spiritual sense, but she also had incredible spiritual intelligence, and her teachings sometimes are very Vedantic and renunciatory. She's very highly intelligent, and so also she's very vital. She had great strength, and she was very uncompromising. She wouldn't do a business with you. She said, this way, well, that's it. And she always spoke from the center of divinity and didn't pull her punches. And though she was a child, she was also a great mother. And she would discipline her children in a very winning way. She became very well known throughout India. One of India's most famous saints of the early part of the 20th century. And Baba met her. Gandhiji met her. And if you've read the autobiography of Yogananda, met her. And eventually she became Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister of India, and became her guru. So, great soul. And these are some dialogues or anecdotes from her life. Okay, so this happened in 1948 on her birthday anniversary. What did I say? 30th of April. 1948, Ma's birthday anniversary was being celebrated in a private garden in New Delhi. She had a number of ashrams around India, and her samadhi is in Haridwar, in Kankal, Haridwar. And one of our trips up there, we visited her samadhi there. Anyway, one morning in the midst of satsang, a weird-looking man entered the garden. Obviously, this is a devotee writing about what happened. He was dressed in a queer fashion, and his face bore a look of insanity. He walked straight over to the women's side and spoke to each woman with her head uncovered. "Cover your head," he said. No one took any heed of him. This seemed to annoy him tremendously. He was obviously getting more and more desperate. Finally, he approached Ma and repeated his request to her as well. She at once complied with his wish and motioned to the girl sitting near her to do likewise and put something. Every woman in the assembly followed suit. The stranger was visibly pleased at his sudden success. With a triumphant smile, he walked across to the men's side and sat down quietly. After some time, however, he got up, announcing in a loud voice that he wanted to leave. Ma handed an orange to someone to be passed on to him. This, for some unknown reason, infuriated him, and he threw the fruit at Ma with violence. It's a very intense moment in satsang. He aimed well, and it hit her. A wave of indignation surged through the crowd. Two of Ma's devotees caught hold of the offender and tried to lead him out of the garden. At the gate, he freed himself from their grip and attempted to return to the satsang. One of the devotees hit him, and with difficulty, the intruder was finally turned out on the street. After the meeting, Ma called the two young men who had dealt with the stranger. She wanted to know all the details. On hearing them, she said, "You are not to prevent anyone from coming to this body. Moreover, you must not beat anybody. To atone for what you've done, keep a fast tomorrow. And you who have hit the stranger may not even drink water." So they had to do penance. "But how could we allow him to throw the orange at you?" protested the young man. "There was no knowing what it might have done next." Ma's reply was, "Never mind. He wanted to return to me. You should have let him do so." Thus, the well-meaning volunteers who had saved an awkward situation at considerable personal risk were reprimanded, whereas the aggressive offender, out for mischief, was treated with unmerited kindness. So unfair life is, isn't it? Next morning, the stranger came again. This time, he was decently dressed and looked normal. I love the commentator. He did not concern himself with the women's bare heads, but straightaway sat down with the men in a dignified manner and remained quiet throughout the satsang. When it was over, he went up to Ma and talked to her. She invited him for lunch, and he stayed until after the meal. He was found to be an educated, cultured, and amiable person. And the day before, he wasn't. Afterwards, it transpired that the throwing of the orange at Ma had caused the man such deep remorse that he was healed of his mental disturbance. He had been unbalanced and was restored to normalcy by Ma's grace. Ma sometimes says, if you must be angry with me, for you'll not be able to keep it up for long. If you focus your anger on me, it will soon evaporate. A great story, huh? You like that one? Interesting. Okay, another one. This happened in 1960. Today, a French lady wanted to know what exactly was the meaning of Mataji's saying, by adversity does he destroy adversity. By adversity does he destroy adversity. Since this may be understood in various ways. Ma, first let us hear what, according to your opinion, these various possibilities are. Questioner. So he said, what do you think it means? Questioner. To be an individual is in itself pain, since it means bondage and separation from the one. But immersed in worldly happiness, the individual is not aware of his sorrow. So God sends suffering and adversity so as to wake him up to the consciousness of his innate misery. What do you think of that one? Ma, yes. You see, happiness of this world is always short-lived, and so you begin to search for permanent happiness. What other meaning do you think of? So in the scriptures it says that there are four kinds of seekers, and some seekers come for knowledge, and some come to escape suffering. That suffering drives them to become spiritual seekers. Some come for yogic powers and some for other things. Some to seek the self. Question. It may also mean that he sends misfortune to prevent disaster. Ma says, this does indeed happen at times. A great disaster is due, but averted by a smaller one. Furthermore, whatever suffering is in a person's fate has to be borne, but when it is exhausted, it is over. From that point of view, also, suffering is beneficial. Moreover, if a very great difficulty arises, one is obliged to turn to God, since one feels utterly incapable of coping with it. Although one may doubt his existence, yet one will start praying to him in so grave an emergency. This happened in Kankal in 1961. A well-known industrialist asked, what was the sense of calling a doctor and undergoing medical treatment since everything was in any case ordained beforehand by Providence? Have you thought of that? That's like the Christian Scientists. They don't believe in using medicine because everything's in God's hands. As if God didn't create doctors and medicine either. You know, that's the point. Ma says, the fact of your consulting a doctor and submitting to medical treatment is also part of your fate. Unless you're fated to be cured, the doctor is helpless. But when you are meant to get well, the right medicine will be given and you will recover. Question. Suppose one has intense faith in God and leaves everything to him and does not consult a doctor. Can one be cured even so? Ma, there are two ways. One way is to have intense faith that God will do all that is needed and pray to him to be cured. If one has reached a state of genuine faith, he will have the power to bring about the cure. If, on the other hand, one's faith is merely superficial, it will not act. So if you take that attitude, you better have 100% total faith, then it'll happen. The other way is not to pray to God for anything, but leave everything to him. Then whether one gets well or not is exactly the same. So you can't even pray to get well. Just accept your fate. Very interesting, isn't it? Is that like, what do they call it, crowdsourcing, or what do they call it, crowd? What's that cure where you just let everybody get sick? What is it?
Herd immunity.
Herd immunity. It's like herd immunity. Is that based on faith or stupidity? I'm not sure. Couple more. Oh, actually, a few. Okay, this was a Christian questioner. It says, I've read in a book on meditation that it is good for a beginner to concentrate on some concrete object or on a symbol, such as the cross, a chalice, or the light of a candle, since to concentrate on the Supreme is very difficult. So you'll even see in Patanjali, there's an object of meditation, whatever it is. It might be a yantra, a mantra, or something else, you know, and you focus on it. Ma says, is this all the book suggests? Why not concentrate on Jesus Christ? If you're a Christian, why not concentrate on the Guru? Questioner, I've not got the courage to do this. The Christ is too holy, too sublime. I could only go wrong in trying. I do not feel pure enough to attempt this. Isn't that interesting? Ma says, all that you perceive, you behold because there is light. Without light, nothing can be seen. There is only one light. Whatever anyone perceives, be he a man or an animal, is seen by the same light. The outer light originates from the inner light. Even a blind person is aware of an inner light. The light of the self is present everywhere and in all. Whether you worship Christ, Krishna, Kali, or Allah, you actually worship the one light that is also in you, since it pervades all things. Everything originates from light. Everything in its essence is light. That's the answer. So don't think that you're inferior, because you are that same light that Jesus is, and worship that light. So she's quite a jnani, isn't she? That light. The one light. Light is wisdom. Light is knowledge. Light is peace. I think we should use that for meditation later. Here's one on meditation. The writer says, a great number of people approach Mataji with the following question. I do not know how to meditate. Neither do I feel inclined to do so. I cannot find much interest in spiritual things, but the humdrum of daily existence also has little charm. What is the solution? Ma says, what this little child would recommend for you is to sit under a tree. Sit under a tree. But there are no trees where I live, the lady retorted. And another one said, under a tree, what kind of tree? A peepal tree? Yes, a peepal tree, said Mataji. By tree I mean a real saint. A saint is like a tree. He does not call anyone, neither does he send anyone away. He does. What does it do? A tree just sits there, it gives shade. If you sit under it, then you get shade. Then you leave it, you leave the shade. So that's the way a sage is. He gives shelter to whoever cares to come, be it man, woman, child, or an animal. If you sit under a tree, it will protect you from the inclemencies of the weather, from the scorching sun, as well as from pouring rain, and will give you flowers and fruit. Whether a human being enjoys them or a bird tastes of them matters little to the tree. Its produce is there for anyone who comes and takes it. And last but not least, it gives itself. How itself, the fruit, contains the seeds for new trees of a similar kind. So by sitting under a tree, you will get shelter, shade, flowers, fruit, and in due course, you will come to know yourself. This is why I say, keep satsang. Take refuge at the feet of the holy and wise. Keep close to them and you'll find all you need. It's not so easy to get satsang, the woman said. There's no great saint in my town and village. And Ma says, if you can't get the company of living sages, read books about them or written by them. That is to say, sacred texts. And above all, try to remain in the presence of God by the constant remembrance of one of his names. If you do this, you're sure to find a living guru who will guide you. And if you can't find a guru, then you can come here and we celebrate all the great gurus and we hang out with them. And one day, maybe you'll get lucky. And finally, last one. What do you think of her?
It's a great.
Great, huh? Okay, a few more. question. Is renunciation of the world a condition, a prerequisite to communion with God? You have to give up the world to realize God. Ma says, you're not called upon to retire to the forest, nor to become inert like a stone, unresponsive to what goes on about you. A lot of people have that attitude about spirituality, that it's to completely cut off from life. And that is a great thing. You have to start life from the position God has placed you in. This is true of what Swami Paramananda was saying about doing what's in front of you. When you meditate, you have to meditate with what's in front of you, not the meditation that you read about in a book or that Baba had or someone else had, but the meditation that you're having. And start with what's right in front of you. And if everything is divine, if everything is the one light, the one truth, then where you are is filled with that divinity. It's only that you're not seeing it that way. So merge with what's happening in front of you and see the divinity in that. In this moment is as full of God as any future moment is. And your present experience is as full of God as any future experience will be when it becomes present. So find that divinity in this moment and be content in this moment. Find the joy in this moment and accept fully, embrace this moment fully. And then you have the touch of the self. So she says, you have to start life from the position God has placed you. Be his servant. If you're at home, look upon your son as Bal Gopal, the infant Krishna. Your little daughter as Uma, the divine mother. And your consort as Narayan, God, or Lakshmi, the divine mother, depending. Don't do harm to anybody. Let the little attachment you've developed to people about you continue within its minimum limit. Don't be concerned if you have attachment to those you love. That's okay. This world is but a dharmasala. Dharmasala is a place where people stay on pilgrimage. It's like a little ashram where you spend overnight and you go to a holy place. So this world is a dharmasala. It's a temporary residence. We're on pilgrimage. We're living here in this world temporarily. When the call will come for your final exit, all the ties of life will have to be snapped, and you won't have a moment's respite. So when the time comes, that's it. And then you have to move on. You pack your bags and vacate the room. The goal of your final union is with the Atma, or self. Forgetting this, you look upon your body as your own self, and that is the root of all bondage, of all the miseries of life. Even while working in the world, that is while you're engaged in your professional or mundane work, you can do one thing. What you do throughout the day, endeavor to do it in a spirit of service. Serve God in everyone. Regard everyone and everything as manifestations of him. Whatever work you undertake, do it as his servant. If you live with this attitude of mind, the path to reality will open up before you. Another Westerner asked the question, what is right for me, to live the worldly life or a contemplative life in seclusion? This is, Ma gave a very short and punchy answer. Just think what you'd answer. And she says, to whichever of the two you give your heart and soul, that is right for you. Or you, I would say, which you can give your heart and soul to. Then do that. Do that. Beautiful, no? So we hail the Divine Mother in all of her forms on this, this day. May there be victory over ignorance and victory over evil. May light suffuse everyone. May there be an end of hatred, an end of suffering. May all beings be happy, and may all beings come to know the self, and may the Kali Yuga disappear, and we live once again in the divine age of bliss and joy and truth. So let's meditate. And what was the meditation? The meditation on the light. You can meditate on many things. You can meditate on the feeling of love. You can meditate on the great power, the energy of the self. And you can also meditate on the light. The light by which you see. The light by which you know. The light of wisdom. That light that pervades everywhere. That light that is divinity. That is consciousness. That is the light of consciousness. The ultimate light is the light of consciousness. Our consciousness is nothing but a light. Without consciousness, there is no light. So meditate on that light, the knower within you, the knowing self, consciousness itself. And meditate on that. We'll meditate now for 10 minutes. And once again, with great love and respect, I welcome you all with all my heart. Satguru Nath Maharaj Ki Jai. Let's meditate now.
Hi, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not check out Swamiji's latest book, Ganesh Pridays, Memoirs of a Western Yogi. It's about the time he spent in India with his guru, Baba Muktananda, in the 1970s, and it's a great read. To get a copy, go to ganeshpridays.com. That's GaneshPuri, days.com. Wherever you are in the world, you can get the book on Kindle or printed in your own country.